This is a sort of homecoming for us. Noam and I knew each other in the heyday of Iqbal's activism, the period of time when J. Edgar Hoover accused him, together with the Berrigans, of being part of what was called the infamous attempt to blow up the heating tunnels in Washington, kidnap Henry Kissinger, and other remarkable accusations. Iqbal was completely formidable in so many people's lives in that period for the sanity and intelligence and uniqueness of his sensibilities about counterinsurgency, about revolutionary warfare, about what it meant to have a war of liberation, and more importantly, a success in terms of self-determination. His academics, his scholarship, his activism was profoundly important and remains so to us. And in large measure, I have personally decided to dedicate Iqbal's legacy to his honor, this course, this colloquium. And so when we thought of this, we thought of reaching out to you, Noam, to think about, coming to think about his life and the impact of his thinking. He was born, Iqbal, in 33 or 34 in Bihar. His reach was global. I also had the honor of being taught by him at the Adlai Stevenson Institute at the University of Chicago. But his writings and, more importantly, his presence, his sophisticated, passionate, quiet, dignified presence was what marked this man's impact, I think, on so many of us of that generation. He infused a remarkable integrity and compassion with sharp, analytical, very keen and biting insights, and I really, truly wish we had him here. Unfortunately, the themes that he has dealt with are salient again. We are dealing again with dilemmas of counterinsurgency, of a worldwide war, allegedly on terrorism, looking at the same dilemmas that we had our class read about. Iqbal's writings, Noam, were assigned in the book that you wrote the foreword to on South Asia. So whether it's Kashmir or elsewhere, we have some insight as to those writings, at least. And some of the questions will probably come to you in that regard. I also have the honor of trying to work for a secular university for South Asia. And a large part of my teaching pedagogy has come from his insights. So it's a wonderful moment, and there's no one better, I think, to bring this alive and to think with us about current issues than Noam Chomsky. Noam is known to all of you as a distinguished linguist, an institute professor at MIT, a prolific writer and critic of US media and foreign policy, but in global affairs has had a very paradoxical, calm, but absolutely withering sense of criticism. And it's going to be a pleasure to have you with us today and to have you think about Iqbal and to think about the way in which we are confronting the issues that Iqbal confronted decades ago. Thank you very much for coming to us.
Well, Iqbal was a close friend, an old friend. In fact, went to visit him, I recall, right after he was indicted on this interesting charge that Chairman mentioned and was at the trial, and went through many things with him together over the years. Resistance activities, meeting with PLO representatives who wouldn't listen to his advice, unfortunately, and many other things. It was an honor to be invited to give a memorial lecture for him in Islamabad a couple of years ago at the Iqbal Ahmed Foundation, though his interests and concerns ranged all over the world and in every possible area, from literature to politics to human life. His spiritual home was really South. So it makes sense to dedicate to focus on Asia and the Asian crisis, although we should say the Asian crises, in thinking about his memory. As Sherman said, he toward the end of his life, he did go back to Pakistan, where he'd been brought up as a refugee from India during the partition. And he attempted, unfortunately in vain, to set up a secular university to try to combat the tide of rising Islamic fundamentalist extremism. It's a courageous act. It could easily be a death sentence in Pakistan. This plague spread in Pakistan, particularly in the 1980s, under the most vicious of the dictators that Pakistan has suffered under since its independence, Zia-ul-Haq, who played a major role in the radical Islamization of Pakistan in the educational system and elsewhere, with substantial assistance and guidance from Saudi Arabia, the most extreme fundamentalist state in the region and our closest ally, and also with the strong support of the United States. Zia was a favorite of Ronald Reagan's, poured money and aid into Pakistan. One of Reagan's legacies is Pakistani nuclear weapons. The program was developed, had been started before, but it was developed in the 1980s. And the Reagan administration had to pretend that they didn't know about it. Of course they did, so that they could cajole Congress into providing substantial military aid, most of which was being funneled to the radical Islamist groups that the CIA was rounding up all over the world to go to Afghanistan with direct Pakistani control, U.S. massive U.S. assistance, Saudi assistance. The goal was not to help the Afghans. That was pretty explicit. The CIA station chief in Pakistan proudly declared that he was sent there with a noble mission, namely to kill Russians, and that they didn't expect to that Afghan would liberate itself, and probably didn't care. The involvement with the Mujahideen probably delayed Russian withdrawal from Afghanistan. It didn't accelerate it. It wasn't intended to. So that's, but in that context, the Reaganites pretended, as I said, that they didn't know that Pakistan was developing nuclear weapons. Of course, they were. And we now have, there are now three states in the world, nuclear states, that have never joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Pakistan and India and Israel, all three developing their nuclear weapons programs with substantial U.S. support. Pakistan, I just mentioned, and that continues. The huge military aid to Pakistan has effectively buttressed the position of the military as the dominant force in Pakistan society over the years. Nuclear weapons is only one aspect. In India, the United States gave a major shot in the arm to India's nuclear weapons program a year ago with the Indo-American treaty that permits India to evade the international and indeed U.S. restrictions that prevent shipping nuclear technology and assisting in nuclear technology to countries that refuse to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty and develop nuclear weapons outside of it. Technically, the aid is supposed to be for civilian nuclear programs, but that can easily, India's made it perfectly clear that they'll transfer that to their use in developing nuclear weapons, and they are expanding. Both Pakistan and India are now expanding their nuclear weapons programs. They've come ominously close to nuclear war twice, mainly over Kashmir, part of Afghanistan, where they're fighting a kind of a proxy war. And the causes of those of that confrontation are very much alive, and it could happen again. and the expansion of their offensive nuclear weapons programs can only instigate further threats, extremely dangerous threats, not only for South Asia, but for the world. There was a very well-publicized Security Council resolution a month ago, September 24th, calling on, which was interpreted here as a calling for non supporting the non-proliferation regime. It was interpreted here as a victory for President Obama in his effort to contain the dangerous Iranian threat. But if you take a look at the resolution, 1887, pick it up on the internet, you can see that it has nothing to do with Iran whatsoever. It's directed against the United States, India, Pakistan, and Israel, against the United States and the three countries who the United States has helped to develop nuclear weapons and is continuing to do so. I never saw a mention of that anywhere, but it's explicit in the resolution. It has two elements, 1887. It calls for peaceful resolution of disputes relating to nuclear issues and simply repeats the UN Charter injunction against the threat or use of force in international affairs, in this case with regard to nuclear issues. There are only two countries that are threatening force, the United States and Israel, both openly and vocally preparing, or at least claiming to prepare for an attack on Iran. The United States, India greeted the resolution by announcing that the second part of the resolution after opposing the threat of force, which happens to be in violation of the UN Charter, if anybody cares, but nobody seems to care about that in the case of the Western countries, the United States. It's taken for granted that these are lawless, rogue states which can violate international law at will, so it's not even discussed. When Obama and others say all options have to be on the table, including the use of force, that is a criminal violation of the Charter and happens to be in violation of the recent resolution, which calls for peaceful means. The other term of the resolution is just simply a calling on states to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty. As I say, there are three who have never joined it, Israel, India, and Pakistan, all with U.S. support. India greeted the resolution by announcing quite publicly that it has now advanced its nuclear weapons programs to the point where it can produce nuclear weapons with the same yield as the most advanced weapons in the U.S. and Russian arsenals. So it's now a super, super nuclear power. This was kind of hard to miss. It was printed on the front page of the London Financial Times, main international business weekly, but I couldn't find any mention of it in the U.S. press. Obama also greeted the Security Council resolution 2 days after he received the Nobel Peace Prize last week. The Pentagon announced that the U.S. is accelerating the development of its what are called bunker busters. They're huge bombs, the biggest bombs and the biggest non-nuclear weapons in anybody's arsenal, 13-ton bombs to be carried, designed to be carried on B-52 stealth bombers and used for deep penetration bombing. Penetrate deeply, they're supposed to be able to destroy anything, even if it's protected by huge amounts of reinforced concrete. Everybody knows exactly what they're for. The program was planned under Bush, but it languished. However, as soon as Obama took office, he immediately called for the program to be accelerated, and the announcement 2 days after the Peace Prize was that they're now being readied for placement on B-52 bombers for the obvious purpose. Purpose may just be psy war, you know, threat, or it may be preparation. Israel, of course, is doing the same. I couldn't find any report of that either. Israel's doing the same with U.S. support. It can't do anything without U.S. support. It's, in the last couple of months, been sending warships and nuclear submarines equipped to carry nuclear missiles through the Suez Canal into the Red Sea, positioning them to be either an invulnerable deterrent or more likely just an offensive weapon, a way to attack Iran from the sea with maybe nuclear weapons, but without having to cross airspace. Well, all that's going on and more while we focus attention on the threat that Iran is allegedly posing by concealing its nuclear programs. Iran undoubtedly is concealing something, maybe nuclear weapons programs, nobody knows, but it's concealing something. On the other hand, other countries are not concealing anything, like, for example, India, which is proudly announcing that it's expanding its nuclear weapons capacity to to the level of the major military superpowers. While there's much concern that Iran is deceiving the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, which is the main monitor of nuclear weapons activity. And they may be or they may not be, it's unclear. But what is clear is that right in the midst of all this furor, the IAEA passed a resolution calling on Israel to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty and to open up its nuclear facilities to international inspection. The West, including the United States, tried to block the resolution, but when they failed, voted against it. It nevertheless passed. Israel, of course, announced that it would disregard it. The Obama administration informed Israel that it would protect it against any IAEA inspection, that it's a long-standing secret agreement that the U.S. will protect Israel's nuclear facilities from inspection. So Obama reiterated that. The media played their role simply by silencing it. So you won't find, actually there's one report that was detected in the English language press in the Irish Times. I happened to read about it in the Mexican press, which is less, not a free country, so therefore they can publish things like that. It was all over the wire services, so there's no doubt that everyone, every editor knew about it. All right, so that's the IAEA report. Concealing is not done by anyone except certainly not by India, Israel, and the United States or Pakistan. Incidentally, the expansion of India's nuclear capacities at once impels Pakistan to try to do something. They can't match Indian capacities. It's a smaller, weaker country. But they can continue to devote extensive resources to trying to develop some kind of a major military capacity, of course, depriving the country of badly needed development. And it also strengthens the army indirectly, and that has effects everywhere, including right now within Pakistan. Pakistan is in a very serious internal situation. If you read the wire services today, it was announced, and maybe you saw it, or probably on the radio, that two major new Taliban attacks have taken place. They're right inside, one of them right inside Punjab, which is very dangerous as the Taliban threat spreads to the Punjab region, the core of Pakistan, the richest part, the part where the army comes from, and so on. That's a real challenge, and the Taliban are hitting at targets which are kind of like a terrorist attack on the Pentagon and the FBI headquarters, you know, the Pakistani equivalent. So they're not disguising what they're doing. This is all a result. The Taliban happen to be based in the Pashtun areas, mostly tribal areas. The Pashtun have always resented Punjabi domination of Pakistan. If they'd had their choice back in 1947, they would not have agreed to be part of Pakistan. The British kind of forced it on them. There was a vote, but an obviously faked vote. The Pashtun were divided by the British into two groups. Britain wanted to include a lot of the Pashtun territory in what was then India, and established a line called the Durand Line, which is totally artificial. The people are the same on both sides of it, and they don't recognize it. And Afghanistan never recognized it when it was an independent state. The purpose was to expand British India. Later it was assigned to Pakistan under the British-designed partition resolution, and deeply resented by the people on both sides. When we talk about them crossing from Pakistan to Afghanistan, from their point of view, it's like my driving from Lexington to Medford today. It's the same area, aside from the imperial worldview. The Taliban are concentrated in the Pashtun regions. The U.S. is trying very hard, and to some extent has succeeded in driving them into Pakistan, which simply increases the problems and tensions in Pakistan. The Pakistani government had a tacit agreement with the Pashtun. It's a lot of people. It's about 40 million people altogether on both sides of the Durand Line. Had a tacit agreement just to leave them alone. That's the way it was under the British. The British tried to conquer these areas, failed, and left them as autonomous areas, and that was carried over to Pakistan after the partition. And in fact, until 2002, the basically Punjabi Pakistani army essentially kept out of these areas, the Northwest provinces, the federally administered tribal areas. But in 2002, under U.S. pressure, the army did attack those areas. And it was a pretty bitter struggle, and it radicalized large parts of the Pashtun population. And that continues as the attacks continue, the radical Islamization continues. The drone attacks in those areas have a very inflammatory effect, according to all the reports we get. Again, you know, creating jihadis, you know, your brother gets killed, okay, you do try to do something about it. And it's simply throwing, lighted matches on a pool of oil. It's worse and worse. And it's getting very serious in Pakistan now. As you can see in the daily press, Pakistan is now, as far as the Pashtun and the other sectors of Pakistan are concerned, Pakistan is just Punjab and the Muhajirs, the immigrants from India. That's Pakistan. It's foreign to them. And there are insurgencies. There's a big insurgency in Balochistan. It doesn't have a big population, but it does have most of the resources of Pakistan. It's a huge area. So that's flaring up in the Sindh regions. It doesn't have to be an insurgency, but this tremendous opposition. There was a Pakistani constitution in 1973 which granted a fair degree of autonomy to the several regions of Pakistan. And if the United States wanted to do something constructive, it would be trying to induce Pakistan to recognize the terms of the constitution and grant a fair degree of autonomy, which would, if it's done properly, could undermine the moves, the insurgencies, and the moves towards separation, separatism in the crucial Pashtun area. It could undercut the long-standing efforts of the among the Pashtun to create a kind of Pashtunistan, including both sides of the Rand lines, Afghanistan, now Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it might undercut the radical Islamization and support the secular groups within the Pashtun areas, the Awami League, which is critical if there's ever going to be any sane resolution of all of this. But that's not happening. What's happening is, in fact, intensifying the conflict. Well, let's go back to the concern about Iran. That's all over the front pages. You know, great threat to the world is Iran. An observer from outside would find this kind of surreal. I mean, Iran hasn't invaded anyone in probably 200 years. Has no troops outside its border. It's not doesn't have military bases all over the world. It doesn't have huge military expenditures. The U.S. military expenditures are approximately the same as close to the rest of the world combined. It's technologically much more advanced. The U.S. maintains its insistence that it's got to control space for military purposes. Under Bush, that was extended to ownership of space for military purposes. There's no sign that the Obama administration is reducing that. Under Obama, the military forces are increasing, not only in Afghanistan, which is what you read about, but the military budget is breaking new records. The Obama administration is asking for more military spending than any president in the post-war period in its first term, close to $600 billion. That's not including the extra funding for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, AFPAC, as they're now calling it. And, well, as I just mentioned, it means extensive new offensive weapons, threat of force. Israel, of course, is a huge military force on its own, thanks to U.S. support, wouldn't be independently. The United States, Israel invades other countries freely. It's invaded Lebanon 5 times without a credible pretext in any of those cases. India holds Kashmir by force and pretty vicious force. There are tens of thousands killed by Indian troops, elite Indian forces. There was supposed to be a referendum in Kashmir. That was part of the condition in 1947 for independence. India's never permitted a referendum, presumably because they know that the majority of the population would probably opt either for independence or for joining Pakistan. Kashmir itself is divided into several regions. Actually, Iqbal Ahmed wrote some interesting and important things about this, suggesting sensible solutions, which naturally nobody's looking at, which could be implemented. But as it stands, a lot of it is under very harsh Indian control, which amounts to an invasion. But it's Iran that we're concerned, and Pakistan is a horrible internal state in large measure, thanks to us. But those are not the countries that we're supposed to be concerned about. The nuclear countries that have never signed the NPT. It's Iran. There's no doubt that Iran has a rotten government, and the government is a major threat to its own population. But the idea that it's a threat to anyone else in the world is a little difficult to accept. We're supposed to be considering now whether Obama's reconfiguration of the missile defense system in Europe is a pragmatic move towards protecting the West from the threat of Iranian attack, or whether it's a concession to the Russians. That's the big debate. The threat of an Iranian attack on Europe is so minute that it is undetectable. You can't find a sane strategic analyst who thinks that it amounts to, you know, a 0.1% probability, for a very simple reason. If Iran had missiles and nuclear weapons, I mean, if it even tried to load a missile, the country would be vaporized instantly. The ruling clerics, who pretty much own the country, have never indicated that they want to turn themselves into radioactive dust in 5 minutes while destroying everything they own. But that's what would happen instantly if they ever as much as threatened an attack. I mean, if Europe wants to defend itself, it would do better to put up an asteroid defense system, the missile defense system. This is not for that purpose, at least. In fact, we all know, at least every strategic analyst knows on all sides, what a missile defense system is for. Missile defense is a first strike weapon, and that's understood on all sides. I mean, if it ever works, maybe it won't, but if it ever works, it could conceivably fend off a retaliatory strike, not a first strike. So essentially, it's a means of eliminating a deterrent, freeing up the country that has missile defense to attack its adversaries without fear of deterrence. It's the only thing it could possibly be working for, used for. Yes, that's what the missile defense might be for in Europe, if it's intended for anything. Maybe it's intended to irritate the Russians, but if it's intended for a military purpose, its purpose is to serve as a first strike weapon. So the threat of an Iranian attack is so remote as not even to be considered. On the other hand, the threat of a U.S. or Israeli attack on Iran is not slight. They're publicly announcing that they're planning for it, they're developing the weaponry for it. Israel's making it quite clear that it's creating the capacity to do this with nuclear submarines, with missiles, maybe nuclear missiles, with the help of the U.S. Air Force. That's the planes that Israel flies. They would have to go, if they fly, they'd have to go over U.S. territory that's either U.S. controlled or controlled by U.S. allies. All of that's very real, and Iran sees that two countries on its borders are occupied by a hostile power. So the talk about an Iranian threat it really requires deep immersion in imperial ideology, deep cultural immersion in imperial ideology, so profound that we can't perceive it. Same with the other cases that I mentioned, and it's easy to continue with this. Well, all of these are pretty serious problems. And they go on. There are other major crises in South Asia. Arin Khan, who Sherman mentioned, Justin came out with a book which was in fact announced today by Amnesty International, holding that the worst human rights tragedy crisis in the world is poverty. And there's good reason to take that position. And the main region where poverty is a major plague is South Asia, primarily India. The by far the largest number of impoverished people is in India. Central Africa, terrible shape, but smaller population. Just today, which October 17th, this is going to be World Poverty Day. The announcement was aimed at that. Today happens to be World Food Day. You hardly know it. The United Nations announced that the number of people facing hunger, serious hunger, has passed over 1 billion. It's increasing pretty rapidly. And one of the main reasons, and it's mostly concentrated in South Asia again, South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. There's plenty of it elsewhere, but those are the worst. That's most of the numbers are from, about two-thirds of the numbers are from the Asian region. It's getting worse. One of the reasons it's getting worse is that the donor countries, the rich countries, are cutting back their food assistance. They've cut it back so much that the UN World Food Program recently announced that it has to reduce food aid, its food aid programs, by about 20 or 25%, because the donor countries won't meet the their promises in the Millennium Fund. That's happening right before our eyes. There's another major crisis looming for South Asia, which might dwarf all the others, namely the melting of the Himalayan glaciers. As global warming increases, the melting of the glaciers is proceeding. It's already easily visible. That'll eliminate the water source for South Asia. That's where the huge river systems come from, and that's a disaster beyond description, and we don't know how far off it is. That disaster will probably be accelerated in the next few months when the Copenhagen meetings on global warming terminate without doing anything except a few empty promises, which is what seems to be happening. There are reports today, you can read them in the New York Times, that the developing countries refuse to try to meet global, pollution standards, CO2 control standards, unless they're assisted in doing so by the rich countries, countries that have gotten rich, of course, by disregarding all such standards. So they want to be assisted. They want help developing technology so they can have cleaner energy and so on. Well, the discussions in the press claim that this is a really serious problem because it would be a huge economic burden on the rich countries if they had to provide this, and they actually give some numbers. You do a little arithmetic, you'll discover that the numbers that they're saying would be the impossible burden amount to maybe a half of 1% of U.S. GDP, something like that, if the U.S. were to do all of it. Do the arithmetic, you can figure it out. But that's the crisis, just as the growing food crisis is traceable right back to the failure of the rich countries to meet their millennium standards. Actually, most of these expenses could be paid, maybe all of them, just by taking the exorbitant bonuses that are being reaped right now by the people who created the financial crisis that we're now in. Front page of the Wall Street Journal this morning exults over the fact that the crisis is over. The Dow passed 10,000. J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs are giving huge bonuses to people and add them up. It's a lot, probably enough to pay the gap, fill the gap in the Millennium Fund and funding technology for the poor countries, but that's not the way the world works as long as we allow it to work this way. So yes, South Asia is facing plenty of crises. A lot of the problems are internal. I haven't talked about those much. But what should be concerning us, I think, is the extent to which we're contributing to these crises. And it's not small. It's in many respects decisive. And it's under our control. You know, these are not problems that are indescribably difficult, that are way beyond reach. These are things that could be improved. And indeed, there are others. I'll just finish by saying another word about nuclear weapons. Obama got the Nobel Prize in part because of his rhetoric concerning nuclear weapons proliferation. I stress the word rhetoric. There's no actions. The only actions are extending the threat. But there are, and there's a debate about whether we can live up to our non-proliferation treaty obligations, which are a legal obligation, the World Court determined, to eliminate nuclear weapons. So is it possible? Is it not possible? Well, okay, we have a debate about that. But there are things that can be done, significant things, short of total elimination of nuclear weapons. Reduction of the stockpiles is one that's discussed. But another one that's less discussed and is very critical is establishing nuclear weapons-free zones in the world. There are now six of them. The sixth was just established a few weeks ago in Africa. The African Union finally got enough states to ratify the treaty on the establishing a nuclear weapons-free zone. But there's a fly in the ointment. There's one country which refuses to support the establishment of this nuclear weapons-free zone, and you can guess which one it is. The U.S. refuses to support it because it insists on opposing the African Union on the status of Diego Garcia. Diego Garcia is an island which, according to the African Union, the African states, is part of Mauritius. Hence, would have to be nuclear weapons free, but it was a British possession, and the British, following the orders of the master, cleared the population out of Diego Garcia, threw him out, sent him off to rot somewhere. They've been running legal cases in England, and they've won often in the courts, but you know what that means. And they're doing it at the behest of the United States, which uses Diego Garcia as one of its major bases for its wars in South and Central Asia and the Middle East. That's a major military base for bombing and, of course, storage of nuclear weapons. And the U.S. and Britain want to keep that. So therefore, the United States is refusing to go along with the treaty, which leaves a big hole in it. The same thing is happening in the South Pacific. There is a South Pacific nuclear weapons-free zone. But first, France refused to go along because it wanted to keep its islands there for nuclear weapons tests. France finally went along, but now the United States is refusing to go along. The U.S. controls Pacific islands, and it uses them for storage of nuclear weapons. It also, the U.S. wants to ensure that U.S. ships, submarines mostly, carrying nuclear weapons have free transit through that area, which would be barred if it was a nuclear weapons-free zone. So that nuclear weapons-free zone is also patchy. Now, that leaves out a third, which is the most important of all. There are a few others, but the most important of all would be a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. Whatever Iranian threat there might be, you can debate about what it is, not very much in my opinion, but whatever it would be mitigated and probably overcome if a nuclear weapons-free zone was established in the Middle East. Now, that's not on the agenda. And it's not on the agenda for two very good reasons. First of all, it would cover Israel. And secondly, it would cover the United States. That is, U.S. forces in the Middle East would not be permitted to, under such a treaty, to have a nuclear weapons capacity. And U.S. military strategy, it's public, you can read it, takes nuclear weapons as the centerpiece of the strategy, of the military strategy. That was true under Clinton, it's true under Bush. Nothing's changed today. In fact, it goes way back. In fact, the U.S. maintains a first strike option against non-nuclear states. It's the only country that openly declares that. Well, hence that treaty is blocked, or more precisely is not even discussed, which is pretty impressive. A large majority of Americans, I think last time I looked, it was about 80%, approve of a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. Most of the countries in the world approve of it. Iranians approve of it. In fact, Iran has formally accepted it even as a government. But it doesn't matter. Also, the United States and Britain are explicitly committed to this. Explicitly. Namely, by virtue of a Security Council resolution, Resolution 687, which was passed in 1991, the U.S. and Britain, it's a resolution calling on Iraq to eliminate its weapons of mass destruction. When the U.S. and Britain were trying to conjure up a kind of a thin legal excuse for their invasion of Iraq, they appealed to that resolution, claiming, you know, falsely as we know, that Iraq hadn't lived up to its commitment to eliminate its weapons of mass destruction, so therefore the U.S. and Britain could invade to enforce that resolution. Well, if you read Resolution 687, one article commits the signers to move towards establishing a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. So above all other countries, the U.S. and Britain are committed to this. But it's not on the agenda, can't be discussed, can't be mentioned. Doesn't matter if a large majority of Americans want it, if the world wants it. That's not the way imperial powers function. And something we should be concerned about in many respects. One of them is that it's simply another indication of the fragile character of our own democracy. Case after case demonstrates that the voice of the public just doesn't matter. You can see it in the healthcare debate, in the financial, in the bailouts of the banks, in foreign policy issues. If public opinion is even mentioned, it's dismissed in case after case. Okay, that's a bigger problem for us than just the things I've been talking about, and a real one. Well, let me stop there.
Noam actually gave a talk for us for EPIC during our Future of Democracy year on Macedonian democracy, which you can still find on C-SPAN.
Well, why don't you pick people?
Hi, my name is Asad. I was just wondering, what's the status on Caledonia University right now? What's the status on Caledonia University right now? Like the university that Iqbal Ahmed was going to set up.
University, what's the status?
Of which? Iqbal's university?
Yeah.
He originally got some. Actually, he goes through this a bit in his interviews, David Barsamian has a book of interviews with him. But at first, he got some promises to he found some rich donors. The government was authorizing it. He got some land. But then they kind of backed off. Apparently it was mostly the Bhutto government just backed off and wouldn't go through with it. And he kept trying, but there were barrier after barrier, and it never got anywhere. And I don't think there's anything being done now to carry it forward. And it would really be important in Pakistan now. I mean, it would be a barrier against the increasing radical Islamization of the country, a lot of which is based in the educational system. I mean, if you read, say, secular activists in Pakistan, like Pervez Hoodboy, for example, close friend of Iqbal's and mine, who heads the Iqbal Ahmed Foundation, he's a nuclear physicist. He's written extensively on the destruction of the Pakistani educational system over the past 30 years, ever since Reagan and Zia-ul-Haq. He says, you know, the students come into the college now where he teaches and don't know, you know, not only don't know, you know, basic physics, but don't know how to think. I mean, all they've come through the Saudi-funded madrasa system in which you memorize the Quran, you know. He says, and also the universities themselves have become highly Islamicized, so the culture has changed. And that's pretty dangerous for the country. I mean, it essentially destroys the future of the country. Actually, it's something that we ought to be concerned about here, too. You know, when you have a society where half the population thinks that the world was, you know, it was created 10,000 years ago, you got a big problem. And that's not the only case. But in Pakistan, it's much more severe. I mean, here there is a live secular culture, and there it's, though it's there, you know, it's threatened, seriously threatened. So Iqbal's effort would have been very significant. I don't know if it's possible to pick it up again, but I don't think anything's happening.
Thank you. My name's Brian. You mentioned in the beginning of your talk that the United States should press Pakistan to allow more autonomy to its various provinces. I'd just like you to expand on that, since it's a very common reading of the Talibanization of sort of the of Fatah and the Northwest Frontier Province is that it occurred because of a lack of a government presence in the East, which the Taliban could provide services instead of the government.
I don't think so. I think it's kind of the opposite. The Talibanization was a consequence of the breakdown of the limited autonomy that did prevail. You can trace it pretty strictly back to 2002, when on U.S. orders, the mainly Punjabi army attacked these mostly Pashtun areas. Well, for one thing, it was a pretty harsh attack. A lot of people were killed, you know, tens of thousands of people driven out. This is a culture that defends itself. And furthermore, it awakens historical memories of Pashtun-Punjab conflict, which go back very far. And strongly strengthened Pashtun radical nationalism. In fact, one of the Zelik Harrison, who's one of the leading U.S. specialists on this region and has written pretty eloquently and extensively on the need to try to implement somehow the 73 Constitution. He, in one of his recent articles, quotes a Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., who's Pashtun himself, who said, who warned that if Pashtun nationalism and the Taliban movement ever come together, he says, we've had it. And he says that's coming very close. And it's coming even closer in the last couple of days as you see the terrorist attacks in the Punjab region aiming precisely at the centers of military and police power. The latest attack in Lahore was what amounts to the FBI headquarters. And there was one in Rawalpindi at a major military headquarters. So I think it's the opposite. And it's probably the same in Balochistan too, that it's the lack of the autonomy that was promised under the Constitution that's helping spur the insurgency. I mean, if people can't get minimal needs and desires satisfied peacefully, they're likely to turn to violence. It's understandable. It happens all the time.
You talked about the nature that we need to grant more autonomy to Pashtun. That way we won't have the conflict between Punjabs and Pashtuns. However, one of the major conflicts in solving the situation in Afghanistan is the fact that the Durand Line isn't recognized by Afghanistan. And a lot of the analysts are saying that the Durand Line isn't recognized by Afghanistan, and that one of the major causes of instability in the region is because this border isn't recognized, it isn't considered legitimate. So in order to solve the situation in Afghanistan, do you think that autonomy in Fatah and autonomy in the northwest frontier provinces is going to only exacerbate what we're seeing and happening in Afghanistan now?
I don't think it would affect what's going on. I mean, what's the problem between the two regions today is that the attacks on the Taliban, mostly Pashtun in Afghanistan, are aimed at driving them into Pakistan. Okay, which exacerbates the problems there. I mean, that's the core aspect of the counterinsurgency program. The problem inside Afghanistan, there is a tribal, an ethnic problem. The problem from the Pashtun point of view is that the government that the U.S. has cobbled together, although it technically has a Pashtun president, Karzai, if you look at the government, it's a warlord government. It's a government of warlords who are mostly Tajik and Uzbek, coming from the Indian-backed Northern Alliance. There's been, like I said, a kind of proxy war between India and Pakistan and Afghanistan trying to gain control. And India has been supporting what we call the Northern Alliance. It's mostly Tajik and Uzbek. And these guys are just gangsters. These are the murderous warlords who the U.S. helped organize in the 80s, and who just tore the country to shreds as soon as the Russians pulled out, were so vicious that the population welcomed the Taliban in the mid-90s. Well, now they're back in power. They're called the government. Of course, the Pashtun bitterly resent it. Most of the fighting is in Pashtun areas. There's a very interesting book about that, about this kind of a personal book, which you might want to read if you haven't done so yet. It's a book by Malalai Joya. She's a remarkable woman. She lived through the Russian occupation, the subsequent warlord monstrosity, the Taliban, and now the current one. And throughout all of these occupations and attacks, she's been working on human rights issues, mostly things like schools for girls and so on, which is a pretty tricky business under these conditions. And she somehow survived. It's kind of a miracle. She has a lot of popular support, and she got elected to the parliament. But she continued to denounce the warlords, and so she was kicked out of the parliament. She now lives underground under heavy guard. She does get out to the West. I think she may be in the United States pretty soon giving talks, but her book describes it all and very, very eloquently. And what she says, I think, pretty convincingly, I think it's supported by other evidence, is that if the Afghans are kind of left alone, they'll resolve their problems somehow. They've made a lot of progress on that in the past. I mean, you know, we talk about the horrible treatment of women and so on, which is correct. But we might remember that women got the vote in Afghanistan before they did in the United States. I mean, there were progressive movements developing, a lot of problems, but the roots are there. And she says the problem that she feels. And there is an Afghan peace movement, which pretty much agrees with her. And I think polls tend to support this, they're basically under attack from three directions. The Taliban, the warlords, which means the government, and the Americans. The way she puts it is, she says, yeah, we need an invasion. We need an invasion of schools and hospitals, not an invasion of M16s and tanks. And that's probably plausible. But the internal ethnic conflicts have to do with the, which are very real, have to do with the imposition of a non-Pashtun India-supported government on a Pashtun, the majority are pretty close to it.
Do you have access to her now?
Pardon?
Do you have access to her, where she's coming?
I saw some announcement somewhere announcing talks of hers, but I'm not sure where. I know how to get in touch with her if you want to know.
Hi, my name is Karan. You were talking about Pakistan in very strictly cultural terms, about the cultural divisions that are there. Looking forward, do you think there is any possibility, based on shared national history, or even religion, of the country being able to come together and forming a cultural forming a national identity in that manner?
Well, before I answer, I should say that whatever I say, take with a big grain of salt. You know, I don't claim to be any specialist on Pakistan, but from what I understand, you know, from reading and friends and so on, is that the appeal of the extremist religious sectors is pretty small. I mean, when there's anything like an honest vote, as there was recently, they don't get much support. So it's basically a secular country, despite what you read. The same is true in the Pashtun areas. I mean, there is a strong secular force, the Awami League, and it can be encouraged. And, you know, I think Zelik Harrison, who I mentioned, makes a pretty good case that, and he does know it, unlike me, he knows what he's talking about, makes a pretty good case that under something like the 73 Constitution, which did grant substantial autonomy, and with a shift in the U.S. effort away from strengthening the military aid just strengthens the military at the expense of civil society. So with a shift away from that and towards legitimate reconstruction, meaning run by, and in the Pashtun areas, that would mean run by Pashtuns, not by Punjabis, you know, so which is what they want. So, and same in the Baluchi areas. With sensible moves in that direction, it might be able to settle down. However, I think nothing's going to settle until the India-Pakistan conflict is resolved. Pakistan will always try to hopelessly match Indian power. So as long as India maintains an aggressive and hostile stance, Pakistan's pretty much doomed. They're never going to just demilitarize when they've got a huge, aggressive, expansionist Indian state on their border. And it's not just Kashmir. And we have a lot to do with it. India is now a military ally, and we are extending the militarization of India, which is, I think, a very bad mistake. Yeah.
Should I repeat it? My name is Alicia, and when speaking about Kashmir and the referendum, a lot of people say that they would obviously choose Pakistan or independence. And I always find the fact that independence understandable to some extent, but what in the light of everything we've just discussed, what Pakistan could have to offer to stabilize, to, I mean, you visit Kashmir and there is so much to develop, you know. It's just, it's basically a land waiting to be developed. It's beautiful. So one, what Pakistan could have to offer. Nothing. And two, if they were independent, in terms of, you know, India being the, you know, everything you've said, the growing power in the region, it just seems so much more logical that if they made peace with India and, you know, came, there would just be so much more to their advantage. I just find myself coming against that roadblock always when people say they'd obviously choose the other two options. While I understand the violent oppression is what
why they would
considers
do that.
People
yeah,
to...
Well, first of all, if I didn't mention it, I should have. There is a large pro-Indian sector in Kashmir. And there's a Buddhist sector, too. You know, it's a complicated place. But it's mostly Muslim. And probably, I mean, if I were there, I wouldn't vote for joining Pakistan, certainly. Probably some sort of autonomy within, I mean, the best thing, I think, is pretty much what Iqbal suggested, autonomy within an India-Pakistan federation, you know, which would break down. If the hostility between old India, you know, imposed by the partition, if that can be overcome, then Kashmir could form part of a federal structure. And it itself has subcomponents. You know, there is a part that leans towards Pakistan, there's a part that leans towards India, there's, you know, the Dach area, off in a totally different direction. And, you know, they could have a degree of autonomy. In fact, federalism is a very sensible kind of solution, I think, all over the world. Take, say, the Middle East. You know, nobody wants to bring back the Ottoman Empire, but in a lot of ways, they had the right idea. Under Ottoman rule, you know, it's corrupt, vicious, everything else, but the basic structure of the society was not unreasonable. I mean, they essentially let people alone. So in the, you know, the Greek corner of Beirut, the Greeks ran it. In the Armenian corner, the Armenians ran it. You could move around the whole empire freely. You could go from Cairo to Baghdad to Istanbul without a visa. You know, it was just a complex. It's a complex mosaic, like most places are. And there are individual parts that kind of want to run their own affairs. Just think about the history of Europe. I mean, the United States is different. In the United States, they just exterminated the indigenous population, so then it's like blank, and you can impose a more or less uniform society on it. But in Europe, the traditional society remained. You know, they weren't, a lot of people were killed, but they weren't exterminated the way they were here. And Europe for centuries was the most savage place in the world, mostly as part of an effort to impose a nation-state system, which has nothing to do with the needs and interests of the people. You got to force it on them. And, you know, finally, I mean, it would still be going on if it weren't that in 1945, Europeans finally understood that if they continue to play this game, they're just going to wipe everybody out. Okay, so now there's peace. And now that there's peace, they are moving towards a kind of a federalism. Those are the halting moves towards the European Union, which are, to some extent, eroding the state boundaries, which are pretty artificial. And if you look around the world, the major wars that are going on are mostly, almost entirely, the result of Europe's imposition of nation-state systems where they don't belong. I mean, take, say, Iraq. I mean, the British cobbled Iraq together from separate groups because they wanted to control it. And they put the border with Turkey where it is because they wanted the oil up there. It breaks the Kurdish areas apart, but that's the way Britain wanted it. So, okay, there's a border there. They took Kuwait, which is basically part of Mesopotamia. They took it out. There was a principality, but it wasn't independent. They took it out and made it independent so as to control Iraq. It blocks Iraqi access to the sea, so Britain had some control. And the same is true everywhere in the world you look. The borders are almost always completely artificial. You know, break ethnic groups, tribal groups, cultural groups apart. They have to impose a kind of unity on what's put together, and that takes force. I mean, you can see it in Europe. Europe didn't even have national languages until very recently. And there's plenty of people in Italy who can't talk to their grandmother because they talk a different language. It's called Italian. Same happened in France. Same happened in Germany. England is moving towards a kind of devolution. Spain, post-Franco, has begun to grant a significant degree of autonomy to several regions, Catalonia, the Basque country, and probably other places. And that's a pretty natural move. I mean, if human society survives, I think it'll go in that direction. And for South Asia, same thing. You know, there's a lot of different, quite different groups that are put together in something that has a single color on a map, which involves imposing a kind of artificial unity on them, often by force, and separating them from people right across this border who are the same as they are. I mean, of Texas, even the language, like Urdu. I mean, Urdu's Hindustani, you know. When they're on different sides of the border, okay, they become different languages, and over time they separate. You know, so they get different idioms, and people can't understand each other, and so on. But same in the Balkans. I mean, Serbian and Croatian are, you know, like Western Massachusetts and Boston. You know, to become different languages when you impose artificial borders, but there's nothing natural about it. And I think in a context like that, the Kashmir situation could perhaps be resolved. And I think this, something similar can be said in many areas. I mean, even the United States, I mean, despite the fact that the settler colonial societies like the United States and Australia are different from traditional imperialism. And traditional imperialism kind of left the societies there and imposed a foreign presence on them. Settler colonial societies just wipe out the population. But even with that, despite all that, still the borders are artificial. I mean, the border between, say, the Mexican border, which is very much contested right now, I mean, that was an open border throughout history, with the same people living on both sides, you know, crossing the border to visit their cousins and so on. I mean, the Mexican border was militarized in 1994 by Bill Clinton, and there was a reason for that. 1994 was the year that NAFTA was introduced, and the planners surely understood that the effect of NAFTA on Mexico is going to be to undermine the economy. I mean, Mexican peasants, you know, pretty efficient, but they can't compete with heavily subsidized U.S. agribusiness. So it'll undermine agriculture. Mexican businesses, you know, can function, but they're not going to compete with U.S. multinationals, which are granted under NAFTA what's called national treatment. They have to be treated like Mexican companies, so that's going to be undermined. And you end up with what you actually see now in Mexico. Mexico, the Mexican economy has basically three components. One is remittances from people who fled across the border. One is oil, which they still have. And a third, which is probably a quarter of the economy, is narco trafficking. Mexico is one of the leading narco traffickers in the world. The U.S. pretends it doesn't notice it because, you know, they don't want to sanction them and so on. The whole leading part of the economy is up to their necks in it. The major corporations are involved, the government's involved, the police are involved. There are huge areas near the U.S. border. People tell me that you can see them from the airplane, which are just taken over by narco traffickers and devoted to poppy production. What used to be there were, you know, agricultural communities. So like, you know, apple growers and things like that. Okay, they're all wiped out by NAFTA. The people flee. The narco traffickers take them over. The government and the corporations protect them. The U.S. pretends it doesn't notice. And you militarize the border and somehow try to keep it there. You know, I mean, none of this makes any sense. I mean, you know, it makes sense for people who are profiting from it, but not for anybody else.
Hi, I'm Saba. Going back to your opinions on Iran, your point of view on Iran and the possibility of it not necessarily being a worldwide threat is one which seems to be very rarely voiced, and even if it is voiced, it's very rarely heard. Why do you think this is, and do you think that this point of view is actually being consciously silenced?
Well, conscious is a funny word. This is a very free country, the United States, so we can, if we like, learn a lot about the thinking of planners. You know, a lot of information is released, and it's very striking when you read it. Actually, there's some good, I mean, I've written about it. Others have done extensive studies on it. What it reveals is that no matter how crazy the ideas, the planners believe them. So, for example, there's a very good book on China by a good sinologist, James Peck, called Washington's China. It's worth reading in this connection. He's the first person to have taken the whole national security record from 1947, when the National Security Council was founded, up to, I think it was 1969, when the declassified record ran dry. And there's some very striking themes through it. There was a conclusion that everyone had. The conclusion is China's horrendous. It's an enemy. Okay. But then you had to prove the conclusion. Remember, this is internal intelligence. It's not propaganda. The people are being paid to tell the government the truth about the world. So the situation was constantly changing. At first, China was an ally of the Russians. Okay, so they're a threat because they're a part of the Russian conspiracy to take over the world. Then there was a lot of hostility broke out between China and Russia. And actually, they were at war. So then the conclusion remained. But the argument was, okay, they're a threat because they're separate from the Russians, and the Russians are kind of moderate, and they're pursuing, you know, a radical overthrow of the world, wars of national liberation. And then it changed again, and you got another argument, but always the same conclusion. I mean, one of the most remarkable things, actually it came out in the Pentagon Papers, I wrote about it in 1973, but the Pentagon Papers has it's not like declassified documents. It's like stealing another country's archives, a conquered country. They didn't want to release it. So you get a much closer insight. And it's pretty amazing. I mean, in the late 40s, the United States had not decided how to react to the various nationalist revolutions that were going on around the world. So like in the kind of tentatively feeling their way through it. And in Southeast Asia, the U.S. ended up supporting the Indonesian nationalist movement, mainly because they'd carried out a big massacre of communists. So, okay, State Department figured they're good guys. And they supported them against the Dutch. They weren't quite sure in Indochina. But by 1950, they pretty much decided, okay, we're going to support France and attempt to reconquer Indochina. And at that point, U.S. intelligence was given instructions to find evidence that Ho Chi Minh was working for Russia or for China or for the Sino-Soviet conspiracy. It didn't matter which, but show one of those things. And they worked really hard. There's a long record of U.S. intelligence efforts to prove this. And they end up concluding that, it's strange, but they said that Hanoi is the only part of Southeast Asia where there's no connection between either Russia or China. Now, you know, anybody who knew anything about Vietnam could have told them that right away. I mean, for the North Vietnamese, their biggest enemy in the world is China, and they didn't want anything to do with the Russians. In fact, they much preferred being allies of the Americans. But they couldn't find any connections. Okay, so it goes back to the smart guys in Washington, you know, Dean Acheson and the big thinkers. And their conclusion is, well, this proves our point. Hanoi is, Ho Chi Minh is such a loyal puppet of the Russians and the Chinese that they don't even have to send him instructions. Okay, so we've proven it. And in fact, the intelligence record runs like that, very commonly. I mean, you can't really call it mistakes. It's ideological fanaticism. In fact, it's very much like the academic world. For those of you who study international relations and so on, it's not all that different. And it's not too surprising that it's not all that different, because they're pretty much the same people, you know, whether you're in the CIA or teaching in the International Relations Department. You have a doctrine, and you can talk yourself into it. It's not like, say, physics, where you do experiments, and if you have a false theory, you disprove it. And you can't disprove any of the theories. You just collect evidence and try to interpret it. And it's easy to hold on to fanatic religious beliefs. So probably they accept it, I suspect, internally. But if you look at the basis for it, it's extremely thin. Why doesn't anyone criticize it? Or why does the government insist on this? Well, I think that's a different reason. There's a principle of international affairs, one of the few principles that has any validity, which you might call the mafia principle. The godfather does not accept disobedience. I mean, if a small storekeeper somewhere doesn't pay his protection money, the godfather doesn't say, well, you know, I don't need that little pittance. And he doesn't go send his goons in to get the money. What he does is send the goons in to beat the shit out of them, so that everyone understands that disobedience will not be tolerated. Well, that's the way the world works. The United States is the godfather, and it does not accept disobedience. And in fact, you know, it doesn't matter how small it is. You know, fishing cooperatives in Grenada, you know, small nationalist movement in the Stone Age society in northern Laos. I mean, whatever it is, it's very dangerous and has to be crushed. Cuba is a good example. I mean, the fanaticism of the U.S. attack on Cuba is incredible when you look at the details. You know, what'd they do? You know, well, you can like them or not, but what the crime was that they were supposed to be a U.S. colony, and in 1959 they became independent. And that, if you look at the record, that's called the successful defiance of U.S. policies going back to the Monroe Doctrine, which you can't tolerate. The Kennedy administration was particularly ferocious about it. Johnson followed, and so it continues up to the present. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, it's horrible, but interesting in that here's a case where for decades a large majority of Americans are in favor of normalization of relations. Well, it's kind of normal for popular opinion to be dismissed. But more interesting is that the business community is in favor of it. And they usually pretty much send fixed policy. But agribusiness, pharmaceuticals, energy corporations, you know, big guys, are in favor of normalization of relations, and they're overruled because we have to keep punishing them. And I think the reason is the mafia principle. Successful defiance can't be tolerated. All right, what about Iran? Well, you take a look at Iran from an Iranian point of view, not our point of view. The United States has been torturing Iran without a stop, without let up, since 1953. I mean, in 1953, the U.S. overthrew the parliamentary government, installed a brutal tyrant, the Shah. The U.S. supported him through all the years of the tyranny. I mean, probably the final blow was when Carter, you know, exuding human rights rhetoric, came and talked about how much we love the Shah and we admire the fact that his people love him so much. And that was kind of like too much. It was probably the straw that broke the camel's back and was a big factor in setting off the revolution. Okay, in 1979, they overthrew the Shah. The U.S. instantly turned to trying to, first of all, reverse it, but also punish the population. Almost immediately, the U.S. supported Saddam Hussein's attack on Iran, which was no small business. I was using chemical weapons with U.S. backing, killed hundreds of thousands of people. People like Ahmadinejad were in the army at that time. That's their experience. The U.S. is trying to torture and kill them. Right after the war was over, they immediately imposed harsh sanctions, and it continues without a break. Well, you know, they are defiant. They are. It's a nationalist country. They're defiant. They're going their own way. And that's not tolerable. It's not tolerable when it's a tiny, insignificant country like Cuba. And it's much less tolerable when it's a major country in a very critical area, you know, the region where the energy resources are. So again, you know, a large part of the American population, probably a big majority wants normalization. American industry and business wants normalization. The energy corporations would love to be freed to go in there and, you know, exploit Iran's resources. Other corporations would love to be trade and invest, it's a big market, but the government won't let them because I think we have to punish them. And the press goes along, you know, routinely, doesn't even think. And most of the intellectual world goes along. And that's their job, you know, subordinate yourself to power. That's what you're trained for when you go through to college and school. And you just pick it up and you keep doing it. So, yeah, you don't hear, even the most obvious things aren't heard. I mean, like what I said about Iran not being a threat. Yeah, you can read it in, you know, say the strategic analysis literature, because it's so obvious that you have to be blind not to see it. But you don't hear it, you're right.
Hi, this is Hussein Zillur from Bangladesh. Two questions, actually. What do you think of South Asia as an analytical construct? How meaningful is South Asia?
As a construct?
As a construct to understand the countries of South Asia. And secondly, what do you think of the democracy discourse as a platform for transformative strategies, even within these imperial designs?
Well, actually, Bangladesh gives a good example of how meaningful the construct is. It showed in 1971 how meaningful the construct of Pakistan was. You know, two parts had nothing to do with each other, you know, different language, different cultures, and so on. And the separation was brutal. Don't have to tell you, but you know, these are just very complicated mosaics of different cultures, and different societies, different languages. I mean, India, for example, is the Indian government is at war in large parts of the country. They're trying to suppress uprisings. Well, you know, how meaningful a construct is India? In fact, India itself. You know, India is regarded here as a rich country. Just to illustrate, a friend of mine who teaches history in a state college did a kind of a straw poll in her classes asking students what they thought were the richest countries in the world. By a big margin, they picked China and India. That's the sense you get when you read the newspapers. You know, these big, rich, overwhelming countries that we can barely survive. You know, but of course, you know, India is there's a small. I mean, there's a minority. It's not small. You know, a huge country, so a couple hundred thousand people who are basically part of the rich West. There's like 800,000 people who are barely surviving. You know, is that one country? I mean, the number of peasant suicides is going up about as fast as they build advanced laboratories in Hyderabad right next door. You know, why is it one country? You know, I mean, it's in some sense, it's a country, and that takes us to democracy discourse. I mean, India is, you know, by world standards, a vibrant democracy. I think more so than the United States. But just what is a democracy? I mean, is it a democracy where popular opinion determines policy? Well, if that's what it is, the U.S. totally fails as a democracy. There's an enormous divide between public opinion and policy. I mean, is Iran a democracy? I mean, they have elections. Candidates have to be, we call it a guided democracy, because candidates have to be vetted by the clerics. What about us? Well, they don't have to be vetted by the clerics, but they have to be vetted by the corporations. You can't run an election here unless you have a tremendous amount of corporate support. You can't get that, you're out of the system. I mean, Obama won the election because the financial institutions preferred him to McCain. So he got a huge amount of funding from the financial institutions, more than McCain, that kind of swung the election. And they're getting what they wanted. You know, that's why the Wall Street Journal is exultant. Okay, it's kind of democracy, but limited. What about the democracy rhetoric? Well, that's actually been studied. So if you want some good studies of it, the person who's done the best work on it, I think, is Thomas Carruthers, written a series of books and articles on democracy promotion. He's a big advocate of democracy promotion, so he's not critical. He's a Reaganite. He was in the Reagan State Department working on democracy promotion policies. He thinks it's a great idea. So he's not critical to start with, but he's an honest scholar. And he runs through the record, pretty much up to the present. And his conclusion is, reluctantly, that the U.S. supports democracy if and only if it conforms to U.S. strategic and economic objectives. Okay. He thinks it's kind of like a paradox. So he says, you know, every American president is schizophrenic. They can never kind of get it straight. Maybe there's like a psychiatric problem or something. It's not a problem at all. It's perfectly natural. They support anything if it supports your strategic and economic objectives. Support tyranny, support democracy. It's kind of irrelevant. But the belief that the United States supports democracy is unshakable. It doesn't matter what the facts are. So take, say, the Arab world, where we're supposed to be supporting democracy. There's been one free election in the Arab world. Very free election, carefully monitored, you know, proved, everything else. Namely, in the Palestinian territories in January 2006. Okay, right in the middle of all the rhetoric about democracy promotion. Did we applaud? No. In fact, within days, the United States turned to harsh punishment of the population for voting the wrong way. And nobody batted an eyelash, you know. I mean, we're all schizophrenic. You know? There's nothing schizophrenic about it. Came out the wrong way, okay, therefore it wasn't a free election. And there's, you know, all this happens without any sense of paradox or internal conflict. I mean, it's tremendous testimony to the religious fanaticism of intellectual culture. They can tolerate complete contradictions, blatant, glaring contradictions, without noticing it. Well, that's the democracy rhetoric. I mean, yeah, the United States would like to have democracies. It's kind of better PR. But only if they do the things they're told to do. I mean, if take, say, Musharraf, Egypt. I mean, vicious dictator. Obama is highly praised for his trip to Cairo, where he gave this conciliatory speech. In fact, that was part of the Nobel Award. Well, you know, he was asked by journalists, what about Egypt? And his answer was something like, well, I don't like to call folks names. He's a pretty nice... When a politician uses the word folks, you know, turn away. That means he's lying to you. Otherwise, you don't use the word folks. But I don't like to call folks names. So, yeah, he's contributing to stability. I mean, maybe there's some problems, but... I mean, it's just a blow to everybody in jail, all the human rights activists, you know, anybody who wants a decent Egypt, but passed over without comment. That's the democracy rhetoric. And in fact, you know, you had the same rhetoric in the Soviet Union. I mean, there's a lot of Russian archives coming out because the old Communist Party hacks are selling anything they can get their hands on to enrich themselves, including the archives. So there is, and there's a huge industry now, scholarly industry, going through the released Russian archives to see if you can find something in it which supports U.S. Cold War policies. It's pretty hard, actually, but they try. However, some of it is actually interesting. So one of the things that's interesting is that you see these gangsters talking to each other, and it's clear that they actually believe what they're saying. So you get conversations between, you know, Gromyko and I forget who, in which they're talking very sincerely about the need to protect democracy in Eastern Europe, against the fascist onslaught led by the West. You know? Now, they're not talking to the public. They're talking to each other in secret. So I presume they believe what they're saying. You know? Doesn't matter how crazy it is. Just like us. You know?
Hi there, I'm Mark. And I'm just thinking about the way in which the various peoples of Afghanistan have resisted central rule for so long. And I was just wondering if you had any specific ideas or recommendations of how the balance should fall between top-down governance and bottom-up governance.
Well, I think there's a strong presumption that any form of top-down government, or in fact any form of authority, has a heavy burden of proof. It's not self-justifying. So maybe there's a justification for it, but you have to hear the justification. And that's true whether it's a patriarchal family or international affairs or whatever it is. I mean, authority is not self-justifying. Maybe there's a need for a top-down government, but then let's hear the argument. If not, then it's the wrong thing. I haven't heard the argument. I mean, there is a top-down government now. I mean, at the top is the United States, and down below it is, you know, Karzai, they're trying to control, and then there's the government, which is just a collection of warlords.
Alexis from the Fletcher School. I would like to ask you whether you consider possible that in this kind of social and internal strife that is prevailing right now in Pakistan, the nuclear armament of the country will fall sooner or later in the hands of the radical organizations, and then if that is the case, what do you think the implications might be?
The implications would be horrendous, but can it happen? I mean, U.S. intelligence and military claims that it can't happen. They say that the Pakistani army is loyal, you know, it's a strong army, they've got everything under control, so don't worry about it. But it's not terribly convincing. The man I mentioned before, Pervez Hoodbhoy, is a nuclear physicist, and you know, knows a lot of these people, a very smart guy, very courageous. He doesn't think it's going to fall into the hands of terrorists, but he does think it's possible that elements of the military, which are themselves involved in radical Islamist movements, might be able to take control of it. I don't have any judgment, but it doesn't sound impossible to me, and it would be really dangerous. I mean, in fact, you know, the U.S. intelligence has been estimating that the chances of a nuclear explosion in the United States are reasonably high, you know, like maybe 50% in the next decade. Way too high to contemplate. They don't mean a big nuclear bomb. They mean something like a radiation bomb going off in New York or something. And if you think about it, it wouldn't be all that hard. Like you and I could cross the Canadian border with a suitcase carrying a 15-kiloton bomb and never get detected. It's essentially an open border. You walk through the forests, you know. Or Graham Allison, who's a specialist on this on nuclear terror at Harvard, pointed out that they said if terrorists wanted to sneak a nuclear weapon, in, a small nuclear weapon, into New York, what they ought to do is wrap it in a bale of marijuana and send it through the New York Harbor. So it, yeah.
My name is Mara. My question for you is, what do you think are the regional implications if the U.S. fails to create a stable central government that's legitimate in the eyes of the Afghans and the country falls back into prolonged civil war, specifically with regard to Iran with its huge number of Afghan refugees?
I kind of lost you somewhere.
Sorry.
Slower. Yeah.
Sorry, I speak really fast. What do you think are the regional implications if the U.S. fails to create a stable, legitimate Afghan government?
And if it fails, yeah.
With regard to Iran, with its huge number of Afghan refugees, and the Central Asian states in the north, which I think get ignored a lot when we speak about Pakistan.
Well, first of all, there's nothing so wonderful about a stable central government. I mean, the take, say, Egypt. You know, it's a stable central government. Saudi Arabia is a stable central government. The Russians established stable central governments all throughout Eastern Europe. You know, Nazi Germany was a very stable central government. It depends what kind of government it is. It could be that, I doubt it, but it could be that the United States could, you know, bring the warlords together and make them less corrupt, and they would cooperate to form a stable central government. Not very good for Afghans, but could happen. And more likely, the U.S. will fail because there's just too much drawing the country apart. And, you know, the surrounding countries do have a stake in what's going to happen there. Like Iran has a stake in what happens in Afghanistan. You know, it's right in the border. They've got strong cultural connections with the Herat area, commercial relations and so on. And they're going to be involved one way or another in what comes out. The same with India, the same with others. I mean, what the U.S. really ought to be doing, I think, is trying to move towards a regional settlement in which the countries that have an interest, a strong interest in what's going to happen there, the neighboring countries, China, Russia also, would try to get together and support an internal development within Afghanistan that would try to resolve their problems. I mean, according to Western polls, a considerable majority of Afghans think that they can sort of work things out with the Taliban and other groups. Taliban are Afghan, after all. And it's a culture which has a long history of negotiations and local settlement and so on and so forth. So, you know, maybe they can work things out. There is a peace movement in Afghanistan. It's hard to judge how powerful it is, but it appears to be reasonably substantial, which is also calling for this. But the U.S. has no right to try to impose a stable government or any kind of government. In fact, a kind of intriguing aspect of the debate that's going on here about what kind of policy to follow is that there's no Afghan voice. You know, you hear McChrystal, you know, you hear Biden, you hear some other guy. These people have no authority to make any decision. Any good or, you know, no good or bad. They just have no authority to make a decision. It's the Afghans who have to decide, and they're missing from the discussion. It's taken for granted that they should be missing from the discussion, but that's just the imperial mentality. I mean, we didn't assume that the Russians had a right to decide what should be done in Afghanistan. Why not? You know? I mean, they might have established a stable government if the U.S. hadn't supported, if the U.S. and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia hadn't supported radical Islamist opposition. They probably would have imposed a stable government. You know? In fact, you know, for Afghans, it might be at least as good as anything we're likely to impose. You go back to the late 80s, say in Kabul at least, not in the countryside, women's rights were protected probably more than, you know, at any time since.
Good afternoon, sir. I'm Samujal. So two points, really. You talked about the nuclear proliferation issues in South Asia. I want to hear your thoughts on nuclear deterrence as an effective tool of averting any all-out war between India and Pakistan since 1998. We had the Kargil issue, we had the parliament attacks, and we had the Mumbai attacks, and before that, the Kabul embassy attacks. We have seen that somehow the all-out war hasn't happened, and the army chief of India at the time of Kargil actually said that nuclear deterrence was an effective reason why they did not intrude into Pakistani territory and, you know, attack Pakistan. So,
yeah. I think nuclear deterrence is a very dubious concept. I mean, it is. There's a literature on it, careful, analytic literature. So, for example, take, say, Israel. It's supposed to have a nuclear deterrent. There's an extremely good book by an Israeli, one of the top Israeli strategic analysts, Zev Maoz. I think it's called Defending the Holy Land or something like that, which is like an 800-page study of Israel's strategies since its origins. He has a chapter on the nuclear deterrent. His view, which I think is pretty plausible, is that it's harmed Israel's security because of what it's done is induced adversaries to develop conventional forces, either conventional armies or terrorist forces, which is a much bigger threat to Israel than a military attack. And in fact, the debate inside Iran appears to be somewhat similar. I mean, we don't know a lot about it, but a couple of Iranian scholars have written about it. Ervan Abrahamian is one. Just looking through what you can get of the Iranian records, he says it seems that the same kind of debate is going on, that there are top-level Iranian analysts who think that they'd be worse off if they have a nuclear deterrent because they would simply strengthen forces which would try to undermine them in a different way. I mean, the Mumbai terror was terrible, but the problem, the thing that you do about terror is trying to find out the causes, not set up a mutual assured destruction system to see that it doesn't go out of hand. And in fact, in that case, it does trace back to Kashmir, apparently. So deal with Kashmir. In fact, we have, you can't speak about these things with super confidence, of course, life's too complicated, but it sort of looks like that from experience. So take, say, Ireland. I mean, IRA terror was no joke. It was pretty serious. And as long as the British responded to it with force, it got worse. It kept getting worse. As soon as the British started, for the first time, paying some attention to the grievances of the Catholic community, which were real, it reduced. It's now almost gone. That's I think, the way to deal with the problem, not bigger and bigger nuclear forces. The nuclear forces can easily get out of control. I mean, the last two wars, it was pretty close to a nuclear war. And it's just not a chance anyone wants to take. I probably ought to go in a minute or two. I wasn't looking at the clock.
Okay, I'll try to make it quick. My name's Marley, and I was just wondering what your opinion was on Governors Atta and Sherzai.
I'm not hearing too well.
Oh, can you? Is this better?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. My name's Marley, and I was wondering what your opinion was on Governors Atta and Sherzai. Even though they're notorious for human rights abuses, their ability to guarantee day-to-day security compared to the central government, just your opinion on that, and if you saw any future in, I guess, that decentralized form of government.
Is that somebody?
Oh.
We've had an analysis of two of the warlords who have provided stability.
Oh, I see, in Afghanistan. Yeah.
Sorry.
Like I said, I mean, the Nazis provided stability throughout occupied Europe. It's not impressive. These guys are simply gangsters, murderous gangsters. If you're tough enough, you can provide a kind of stability. People are afraid of you. But that's not anything to be looked forward to.
Hi, my name is Matt, and just going back to developing countries and the fact that whether that will be sustainable or not, I've heard that many developing countries will refuse to develop sustainably if major countries like the U.S. And other world powers don't come to Copenhagen with legitimate sustainability laws in place. And at this point, it seems unlikely that the U.S. at least will do that by the Copenhagen meetings. And I'm just curious as to what you think the major barriers are and why that won't happen, most likely.
Well, the U.S. has to take the lead in this. I mean, we're the richest country in the world, just in terms of, say, carbon dioxide emissions. Per capita, we're way ahead of anyone else. The country developed on the basis of destroying the commons, basically, just as other industrial countries did. And unless we do something serious and really take the lead on it, I don't think anything's going to happen. But can we do it? Well, that's a problem of internal U.S. democracy. I mean, the population is committed to it, or at least by polls is committed to it. Could be more so if there was, you know, real education going on and organization. But business is strongly against it. The American Petroleum Institute, which brings together most of the energy corporations, a couple of weeks ago just announced publicly that they are going to follow the model of the health insurers, you know, town meetings, all that kind of stuff, to try to undermine any energy legislation, any energy or environmental legislation. Well, yeah, you can do it in a business-controlled society. I mean, look what happened with the health plan. I mean, you know, what's coming through is like a joke. And it's against the wishes of a large majority of the population. But there's been enough the centrally organized and powerful and wealthy sectors, financial institutions, insurance companies, drug companies, yeah, they've been able to gut it. I mean, for example, 85% of the population here thinks that the United States ought to join the rest of the world and allow the government to use its purchasing power to negotiate drug prices. Obama made a secret agreement with the drug companies that that won't happen. Okay, so 85% disagree. Let's go on to the next topic. This, it's the same in every other aspect. So yeah, in fact, you go back to last August, Business Week, you know, had a front page cover story with a big headline saying insurance companies have won. That was August. They're not satisfied with their victory. So now the last couple of days, they're pushing harder to knock out the last few things that might do something for the public. And the energy corporations have taken note and say, we're going to do the same thing. They were immediately joined by the Chamber of Commerce, which is the biggest business lobbying group, and other business lobbies. There's a few splits among them. So, you know, Apple pulled out and a couple other people pulled out. But that's overwhelming. And if we allow the country to be run by corporate power, nothing will get through. It's not because they're bad people or anything. It's just that they have an institutional stake in short-term gain. I mean, there's a principle, you know, it's kind of built into the institutional structure of the corporate system that you must try to maximize short-term gain. If you don't want to do that, you're out of the system. Okay? So you'd be the nicest guy in the world, but if you're in the system, that's what you're going to try to do. And if that's what sets policy, we're basically doomed. So the question is, you know, can you have a functioning democracy? Well, it takes work. It doesn't happen by itself.
There's a challenge for you.
Yeah.
No, thank you very, very much.
Okay.